Dakota has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
Okay, folks, thank you very much indeed for joining us today. You are, of course, listening to Life on Planet Porky, the podcast that is searing across the universe. In fact, many universes. In fact, even the Milky Way. How's the milk supply, Leslie Ann?
Well, the oat milk supply is doing very well at this end. Thank you, Michael.
Yes, good. I'm glad to hear that. And I really want to thank all the people who are tuning in and listening to Planet Porky. Our numbers are steadily rising, which is a great thing. Thank you very much indeed for those who've jumped on board. We will continue to try and provide you with the entertainment and information generated by the combined brain power of myself and Leslie Ann. Now, Leslie Ann, I don't know if you're aware of this, but you may have seen some reports in the last couple of days of my broadcasting colleague, Mr. Alan Brazil, performing as a hero in Spain. He's got a place in Marbella. He goes over there, goes out for lunch, a place called Laguna, and he's in a restaurant in a complex of sort of, you know, restaurants and shops and bars and that kind of stuff. And he's suddenly aware of the fact that there seems to be sort of bits of soot and that sort of stuff floating around and dropping into his soup, and looks up to find that the thatched roof across the whole of the complex is on fire, and everybody's got to get out, got to evacuate. Al runs into the kitchen, alerts the chef and the cooking staff, guides him out to the restaurant, and within minutes, the place was burnt down. It was horrific. And there's a video of Al standing in front of the building with the, and it's burning down behind him. But the one thing that everybody points out to me when they look at the video is the fact that in his left hand, he still has his glass of wine, which he rescued from the table, even though the flames were licking about him. Some story of heroism, I think.
Well, I think he actually needed that glass of wine, didn't he, after what had just happened? But
yeah.
I think I'm right in saying that he thought it was a barbecue that had sort of gone up in smoke, as it were, to begin with, and then realised what was going on. But how brave of him to go running in and alerting people to the fact that a fire had broken out.
Well, that's the sort of guy he is. And obviously, he'd had a few sherbets before the fire broke out, so he was well aware of what was going on. Had the fire got him, the amount of alcohol that Al consumed over the last 20 or 25 years, he'd have gone up pretty quickly, believe me. But we must have made jokes. It was indeed.
Well, that's an awful thing to say.
It is an awful thing to say.
You really are dreadful. But I read that 3 helicopters came in, there were 30 firefighters. Thankfully, no fatalities.
Well, thankfully, no fatalities. But he said it went up in seconds. You know, it's just, I mean, you can imagine all that thatched roof type stuff in the sort of heat that's generated on that part of the Spanish coastline. So, but as you quite rightly say, thankfully, nobody's injured. Now, a rather sad story, Leslie Ann. I didn't know a bloke called Chadwick Boseman, I have to be honest, until I read of his very, very sad demise over the last sort of 36 hours, really. And then I sort of got onto the story and, you know, I accept now, understand now, he was a superstar of an actor who broke through all sorts of glass ceilings, involved in the race relations situation in the movie industry. But he's the first truly black superstar, superhero. Kids loved him and all that kind of stuff. But what really struck me is the tragedy that somebody who'd made such an impact and had literally changed the world and done so much good is taken away from us at 43 years of age with colon cancer. Anybody who goes early, who's got so much to offer to the world, and I include the subject of your forthcoming book, John Lennon, who was murdered at 40. This guy was 43. Steve Jobs went too early because Steve Jobs, the founder of Apple, went too early because he had cancer as well. It doesn't seem fair, does it?
Well, no, it doesn't. But you've got to look at the wider picture here. You know, the great Russian writer Alexander Solzhenitsyn wrote that when you die at a young age, you remain that age for eternity. Yeah. So people will always relate to you as that young person, and you become even more of a role model. Yeah. So this guy is not going to be forgotten.
No.
And he's always going to be revered as the first black superhero.
Yeah, no, he will indeed. In fact, you gave me a bit of stick for me highlighting the fact that you'd taken a shine to 90-year-old Sean Connery, the original James Bond, of course.
And yeah, what was that about?
Well, you know, you spoke about him in very flattering terms.
That doesn't mean to say I fancied him.
Oh, well, come on. I mean, you know, most of the women in the world did when he was in Goldfinger and Thunderball, so I don't think you would have been an exception there.
Yeah, but I was far too young to have related to him in that way, you know?
Yeah, but when you got to the age where you were relating to men, he would have then been a mature man. And you probably would have related to him then. But the point
I think my dad would have run a mile if I'd have got involved with somebody like that. I would have taken a hiding for it, as he used to say.
Yeah, taken a hiding. I'm sure you would have done. But no, what I'm saying is I don't really want to see a picture of Sean Connery now at the age of 90. Just to emphasise your point, you know, when you're frozen in time, John Lennon. You're quite right. I mean, the oldest picture we've got of John Lennon is 40 years of age. The oldest picture we've got of Paul McCartney is nearly 80. And you're right. You're frozen in time when you've died young, aren't you?
Well, look at Princess Diana, who's, you know, her sad anniversary is upon us yet again. But look how beautiful she remains.
Yeah.
She's iconic. And compare her to the wife of the heir to the throne now, who's sort of aging gently, isn't she, I'd have to say.
I think she's aging gracefully, Camilla Parker Bowles. I think she's, you know, I think she does it with a smile on her face and all that. And people embrace getting older. I remember one guy I used to work with when I worked in Chester, and his name was Ian Skidmore. And he actually said he was really looking forward to older middle age. He was middle-aged then. He was probably about, you know, 45 or something like that. He said, I can't wait to get to 55 or 60. I'm really going to start enjoying my life then. So I think some people see middle age as, you know, heading towards retirement. That's not my attitude. I like to keep busy.
I had a girlfriend at college who used to say she was really looking forward to being a grandmother.
Yes.
And I used to look at her and say, what? She was a very beautiful girl, sort of Anglo-Indian girl, a very stylish, lovely person.
Yeah.
And I couldn't understand why she would want to give up her beauty to be older and to be a grandmother. But I suppose as we get closer to those kind of stages in life, we have no choice but to embrace them, do we?
Well, you've got to embrace them. If I look at a picture of myself now as a 21-year-old reporter on the Chester Chronicle, I was even better looking than I am now. I had a full head of hair. you know, I had a very distinctive authoritative type of face. And sometimes you look in the mirror these days and you think, my God, imagine if you'd gone from that at 21 to what I am now overnight, you know what I mean? Like some terrible conspiracy and lost all those years in between. But no, you're right. Now, talking about youth and frozen in time, today is the anniversary of the release of Definitely Maybe, the first Oasis album. Came out in 1994, went straight to the charts in the days when people went out and bought LPs in record shops like WH Smith and all that. But how does a record that's put together by a group who'd never been heard of suddenly get straight up to number one, bang, and then create a world dynasty?
Ah, the phenomenon of the debut album, you know, but of course it's not about they come out of nowhere and go straight to number one. This is all about word of mouth, live gigs, singles, press, reputation, hype.
Yep.
A lot of it was hype in those days.
Yep.
But there have been many, many examples of albums released that have gone straight to number one. Please Please Me, for example, you know, which people tend to forget. But even in recent years, you know, you've got, I'm sure you've heard of Lewis Capaldi.
Yes.
Divinely Uninspired to a Hellish Extent, his album. Emily Sandé back in 2012, Our Version of Events. Sam Smith did the same thing. The Arctic Monkeys, McFly, Nora Jones, Coldplay. These are all recent examples of that phenomenon.
Yeah.
It's no new thing. And it is a combination of effort on the part of everybody. But we must never forget that these artists do tend to have a vast underground following before they ever go mainstream.
Yeah, well, yes, I accept that. And so, for instance, take Led Zeppelin. they were made up of underground musicians, weren't they, really? And so,
well, session musicians, yeah. Session guys who worked in the studio and on stage, on the road for other artists.
Yes, that's right, yeah. In fact, the one story I remember about that was Keith Moon, the legendary Who drummer, was talking, I think, to Robert Plant, or it might have been Jimmy Page, and they said, we're putting a group together, and Moon said, and who's in it? And he told him who's in it. He said, you'll go down like a lead balloon. And that's why they called themselves Led Zeppelin, but they took the A out of lead because they knew the Americans would pronounce it as lead, and the rest is history. And of course, they were just a group of guys who got together, produced a heavy metal record, and they went straight to number one, didn't they?
Oh, yeah. And the other thing, of course, that they did, they never released singles. No. It was only ever albums.
Amazing. Absolutely.
So that was a new thing as well. But yeah. And all their albums were called Led Zeppelin, which was interesting.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, it wasn't exactly a brainstorming session to name the next album, was it? Now, Leslie-Ann, I need to talk to you about something which I don't know. This distresses me. I'll have to raise it with you, a woman of your elegance and charm. But I don't know if you know this, but on television this evening on Channel 4, for the first time ever, there is going to be an image of an erect penis in a show. And it says this is an edgy Channel 4 documentary, Me and My Penis. And it contains photos and footage of 8 erections. Now, this makes me want to throw up. You, as an elegant lady, must be appalled.
Why? It's not something I'm going to sit down and watch. I've seen it all before. You know, why do we want that on television, really? It's not going to upset and shock me, but I don't particularly want to watch it on TV. Yeah. I certainly don't want to watch it with my kids.
No, exactly.
I think there's a time and a place for this kind of thing. Yeah. It's not disgusting. It's natural. It's biology. It's the reason we're all here. So, you know, I can't take offence at it, but I don't see why. I mean, look, John Lennon made a film about his penis, didn't he? I think everybody thought it was a bit of a laugh. But
he's John Lennon, and he did it because he was eccentric. He was the most famous rock star in the world, and they do things like that. But this, I just think this is appalling. I think there are certain things which should remain private under all circumstances, and flashing erect penises around, in my view, I think it's appalling, and I would have banned it, to be honest. I wouldn't let it be.
Well, follow the rabbit down the hole. You know, how would we feel about looking at female genitalia on television?
Exactly the same. I think that, you know, there are privacy laws and rules and censorship rules and all that, which should have been applied here. In fact, I don't really even like talking about it. I feel embarrassed talking about it to a woman of your elegance and demeanour.
Well, don't fear on my account, Mike. It is a natural thing, isn't it? But I just think there's a time and a place. Keep it to yourself. Keep it private.
I totally agree. It says here, Channel 4 clearly feel that in more open-minded times, there's likely to be fewer complaints from viewers, particularly as the show airs at 10 p.m., which is well after the watershed. Well, in my view, there's no time. But anyway, there you go.
The thing is, we have a choice, don't we? We don't have to watch it. I'm not going to. And we can also use the off switch.
Yes. Well, yes, of course we can. You're absolutely right. Now, Leslie-Ann, you and I have both worked and lived in America at various times. And you watch you keep up to date with the news, obviously. What's your impression of what's going on in America at the moment as we go towards the election with Trump, you know, holding massive rallies outside the White House, unprecedented in my lifetime, and Joe Biden having to face up to the realities of not condemning people who are rampaging around America, burning up whole towns?
It's terrifying, isn't it? We're looking at two Americas right now, a completely divided country, and it's obviously a vast country.
Yep.
I read in the New Statesman that Biden has got an 85.6% chance of winning the election, according to their election model. Mm-hmm. The thing is, we know, don't we, that most states in US elections are fairly safe.
Yes.
Voting for the same party election after election.
Yes.
So that the race for the presidency is quite a scrappy thing decided on a handful of swing states.
It's down to about 18. It's about 18.
Yeah. Places like Georgia and Iowa and Michigan.
Pennsylvania and places like that.
Yeah, those kind of states.
They're called battleground states. And you're absolutely right. It's a percentage swing of 2 or 3% in those areas.
what you've got is a race divide, which was always going to come.
Yeah.
And I think this eruption of 400 years of enslaved Africans first brought to Virginia, you know, way back when, I think most Americans don't know or understand the full story of slavery. This is partly the problem.
Yeah.
Because the trade of human beings was no new thing, even all the way back then. People had always been enslaved and sold as commodities to each other.
Sometimes, you know, the pyramids were built by slaves and all that kind of stuff, you know.
Which is partly why, you know, when you look at people demanding that statues are taken down, for example, it's sort of symbols of great slave traders, as they're known, removed. It was, you're absolutely right, the pyramids were built by enslaved people.
Yeah.
So what are you going to do? Go and knock the pyramids down? Mm-hmm. I don't think so. That kind of thing has got to stop at some point.
Yeah.
But the whole idea of eradicating all those hundreds of years of history, shameful history, and creating an equal America, this has taken too long to come. And it's no wonder that finally it's erupting. It's all boiling over.
Yeah.
And Trump isn't equipped to handle it. And he's no role model for these people, is he?
Well, I don't think Joe Biden's equipped to handle what's happening. He doesn't seem to be able to get a grip of it at all. The most terrifying images I've seen come from DC, Washington, DC, of that crowd barged, you know, down a row where two women were sitting outside having a coffee or something. And they had raised fists and demanded that this woman raised her fist in solidarity with the Black Lives Movement. And she said, look, I'm very sympathetic to, you know, a lot of the campaign of Black Lives Matter. I don't agree with all of it, but I'm not raising my right fist just because you tell me to. And she was barracked and bullied and shouted at. And it was a very, very unpleasant scene. And like you, just like you, my heart breaks to see America torn in two like that.
Well, this kind of thing was going on in Germany in the 1930s.
It was. Yeah, you're right.
You know, we all know what happened after that. So I'm fearful of where this is going to end.
Yeah.
And I don't think any election, any political stance, any campaign on the part of the president is going to make a difference. The difference has to come in the way America is policed.
Yes.
And the way that Black people and white people are given equal opportunities. And I think they're a long, long way from that.
No, I totally agree. I think it's an interminable problem. Getting to images, which I just talked about, what do you make of this guy, this MP? His name is Dr. Luke Evans. He wants to introduce legislation so that if celebrities have their images altered and then published, you know, anywhere, like online or social media or newspapers and magazines, then unless it clearly indicates this image has been altered, they should be fined and the images should be taken down. And he says this is because young people are so affected by, you know, their own bodily shapes and all that, that these celebrities will be leading children into despair and distrust. And I think it's nonsense, isn't it? You can do whatever you like with your own image, can't you?
Yeah, I think this is a really good idea. I have to disagree. Really? I mean, we're all familiar with the sidebar of shame on the side of the Daily Mail, aren't we? With all the celebrity pictures. Mm-hmm. And, you know, online you've got on various kind of sites that people use to post pictures, all kinds of influencers putting up. There are even people who put pictures of the before and after. So this is my picture when I pose like this, and this is what I actually look like.
Yeah.
And so they've started to almost shame themselves, really.
Mm.
And I think that body dysmorphia is a huge issue, especially in this country right now.
Yeah.
Many, many young people are starving themselves to try and look like celebrities because they don't know better. They're not getting good guidance. So, yes, I think to stamp pictures with, you know, this photograph has been modified or some kind of labeling to indicate that this is a fantasy, this is not reality, and don't try this at home.
Yes.
I think would be a really good move.
Really? Oh, well, blimey, I just felt that, you know, it's the nanny state gone mad if you can't even alter a picture, particularly from the public eye, and say, look, I'm looking at my best. But anyway, there you go. Talking about stars, by the way, today is the 76th birthday of Mr. Richard Gere. Now, I never really fancied Gere at all. You know, the only two films I've seen him in were Pretty Lady Was it
Pretty Woman? I think it was.
Right, yeah, Pretty Woman. Yeah, get that. Right. Well done.
Same thing.
Same thing. Pretty Woman, which I thought was great, but it was the film was stolen by Julia Roberts, who was brilliant, and I thought he came out of a bit of a pompous ass. And then Officer and a Gentleman. And again,
oh, with Deborah Winger, yeah.
And I thought Deborah Winger stole that film. I thought she was brilliant. But I never rated Gear. And then I don't know if you saw this because you're not a great television watcher, but a year ago or 2 years ago, there was a great TV series about another media empire. And it wasn't the one called Succession, which is Brian Fox or whatever his name is, somebody Fox. Barry Fox, I don't know, some Scottish chap, but yeah. And
Mr. Fox.
Mr. Fox, that's right. And it wasn't a documentary on the Murdoch family, which has happened. It was another one. And Richard Gere was this sort of, you know, multi-billionaire international media giant who, you know, had deals all over the world and a warring family below him. And he was absolutely appalling as this, you know, this megalomaniac type publishing baron. And the only thing that he seemed to have in his locker in terms of, you know, expressing himself was raised eyebrows or a frown looking at the floor. And that's all he ever seemed to do. And it just endorsed my view that I don't think he's a very good actor.
I had a run-in with him in 1992.
Oh, really?
He'd made a film called Final Analysis. I don't even remember it.
Yeah.
It was one of his big films with Kim Basinger, who I thought was brilliant. But of course, you know, she fell prey to the whole Hollywood thing of women reaching a certain age and being too old to make films anymore. This does not happen to men.
Yeah.
So I was sent to Philadelphia to interview Richard Gere for about this film.
Yeah.
And it was
Eternal Love.
Huh?
The City of Eternal Love.
Is that what they call it? It was one of those situations where it was hate at first sight. You know, he couldn't stand me
and I couldn't stand him.
I don't know. We just took one look at each other and really hated each other. And that's never happened to me before or since.
Yeah.
And I sort of looked at him and he was very poorly dressed. He had on a sort of blue blazer, black slacks, brown shoes, a kind of maroon belt. Nothing matched. Yeah. Nothing was, he was completely unstylish. And this offended my eye. Maybe I was sort of influenced by that. I don't know. But every question I put to him, you know, I would say, you know, you say so and so and so. Well, I don't say that, lady. You say that. Yeah. And he was very offensive.
Yeah.
And when I came back to London, I wrote the piece and I was very proud of it, actually. It was one of my better pieces. And I, you know, one very rarely got called into the editor's office, which in those days was Sir David English.
Yeah.
I think it was the only time I'd ever been summoned by David English. And in I go, I trot into his office thinking, oh God, what's happening now? Am I getting fired or what? You wouldn't normally get fired by the editor-in-chief.
Yeah.
But here I am sitting there and he says, he has a spike on his desk. Do you remember the spikes that they used to have?
Yeah.
Where copy would literally be spiked right in front of you, as in the pages would be rammed down on this big metal spike, as if to say that's going straight in the bin.
That's right, yeah.
And he said, I can't run this piece. I said, why not? He said, it's disgraceful. And he spiked it right in front of me. So I was shamed in front of the editor-in-chief.
Yeah.
I came back out to my desk with my tail between my legs.
Yeah.
And the features editor came over to me, said, what happened? I told him. And he said, you can't write this stuff, LA. I said, why not? This is one of my best intros ever.
Yeah, what was it, by the way? What
the intro was, the most genuine thing about Richard Gere is his Rolex. And I said, what's wrong with that? I think that's really funny. And the features editor said to me, what you have to understand is that Sir David English wears a fake Rolex. I said, you're joking. He said, no, I can vouch for the fact that it's a fake. I was with him in Hong Kong when he paid $30 for it.
Good job.
So English was offended by the fact that I had written about his Rolex. You know, this was obviously an Achilles heel.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Well,
but other than that, I thought it was a very fair piece, considering Gere had given me such a hard time. We used to call him Richard's Gere, of course. And you must remember the stories about the hamsters. You've got to remember those.
Yes, I do, but I didn't want to repeat it on a family show like Life on Planet Paul.
Let's just say a hamster wrapped in cling film and leave it at that.
I think we should. And if anybody asks, please just refer to Google or something like that, and you can find out what's happening. What intrigues me, Leslie Ann, is that this sort of hate at first sight thing, because although you are a very talented and gifted writer and you are a great journalist, I think...
He says all the right things.
Yes, I do. You wouldn't disagree, would you, that one of the reasons why you did your job so successfully is because you were very easy on the eye. You are still a very good-looking woman. You are a vivacious younger woman, and no bloke would have turned you away had you walked into the room and said, I want to talk to you, you know? So why did...
What are you saying, that I was sent as bait?
No, I'm not saying sent as bait. I'm saying you've got a better chance of talking to people if you're better looking, male or female, okay? I appointed a showbiz writer once who was incredibly good looking and had a very fulsome figure, and I did it deliberately because I thought the minute she walks into a room, you know, with any male pop star, any male actor, nobody's going to turn her away. And I was absolutely right. And I think you would have had the same effect on males. So I can't understand why Richard Gere suddenly took a dislike to you.
I think probably because he rumbled that. You know, it's a bit of a ruse, isn't it? It's a bit of an old-fashioned idea.
Really?
Send a cute little chick along and charm the guy. I think that it happened with men as well.
Yeah.
I mean, we both know our share of former reporters who were very good-looking young men, for example.
Yes, that's right.
So I think it was just a pretty young thing was sent along to sort of reel them in. And he must have had that so often in his time and probably was bored. You know, lots of these celebrities don't even like being interviewed at all.
No.
Freddie Mercury was one. He absolutely hated journalists.
Yeah.
There was only one journalist he ever gave the time of day.
And that was you.
And that was David Wigg.
No, it was you as well.
No, it wasn't really me at all. It was David Wigg.
Oh, blimey. Well, that's so interesting. But that's a very good analysis.
But that tells you everything about Freddie Mercury, of course,
doesn't it? Well, absolutely, yeah. But that's a very good analysis. So Richard Gere thinks, oh, they've just sent some, like you say, some rock chick writer along, hoping that I'll spill my thoughts to her because... She's easy on the eye. That's a very good point.
He had a big brain, of course, and he was very proud of his intellect probably thought he wasn't going to get much of a conversation on that level from me.
Yeah, well, maybe. And that manifested itself, by the way, in the film Pretty Woman, where he wrote into the script that the guy who was the businessman was also a genius pianist, you know, always going down and playing the piano, because that's what they do, isn't it, these guys? They try and project themselves on the silver screen as they see themselves in their own image.
Coda has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
So, Leslie Ann, I'm so delighted I'm talking to you today because I have got a big announcement to make, and that is that I am thinking very seriously. In fact, I'm going to embark on a gluten-free diet, and I need to know what gluten-free is all about, what good it will do me, am I wasting my time, or will it restore to me some energies I may have lost over the last few years?
Well, who's advised you to do this?
Nobody. The thing is, I read so extensively, and I read medical pages in particular because I've got so many medical problems, you know, diabetes, heart disease, you know, various knee injuries, all that kind of stuff. So I always scan over the health pages, and I came across this sort of two-parter on gluten-free diet and all that, and then looked up and saw what the benefits of it are. Apparently, it restores a lot of energy to your body that's been sapping away for the last few years.
Well, first of all, very few people need to be on a gluten-free diet unless they are celiacs. They have celiac disease. Like Mary Wilson, you know, the singer, Miss Beehive. She's a celiac, so she has to avoid gluten because it would otherwise make her very ill. It's a combination of two proteins, and it's found in the grains, wheat, barley, and rye.
Right.
So you can quite easily avoid bread, biscuits, cakes, all that kind of thing.
Yeah.
You also have to avoid some quite unusual things, which a lot of people don't take into account.
Yeah.
Things like condiments, alcohol, processed meats, sweets and treats, that kind of thing. But you can restrict your diet to... Sorry?
You can't eat anything in that case.
Well, yes, of course you can, because you can eat meat, you can eat fish, you can eat fruit, vegetables, rice,
hang on, what about my
potatoes?
Sandwich?
Well, you can't have a sandwich because that's made of bread.
That's what I'm saying. But if you toast it, apparently it's better. Is that right?
Well, I don't know about that. I think the idea is that you avoid it all completely. Yeah, but yeah, yeah. I mean, there are lots of advantages. People who are gluten sensitive tend to have more headaches.
Yeah.
They have skin problems, digestive issues, neurological issues. They get acne and they can feel generally weak.
Yeah.
I think it's one of these things that take it with a pinch of salt, as it were, you know, give it a try and see whether you feel any different. My guess is that it's not going to make that much difference at all.
Really? Oh, well, maybe I'll, you know, it's day one today. I had, so I had bacon and sausage for breakfast, but instead of putting it into a butty, I had it with boiled potatoes, okay? And I'm hoping that that's going to...
Boiled potatoes for breakfast?
Yes, that's right,
Oh, it's yummy.
No, I love baby potatoes. I love boiled baby potatoes. They were left over from my Sunday roast, you see. So I put them in the pan and fried them. And so I had sort of hash browns with bacon and sausage. And I'm thinking to myself, that's going to be an improvement on the bacon butty, but who knows. A few weeks ago when we were talking about various pop stars that you've interviewed during your life, which is almost everybody who's ever lifted up a microphone, I have to say, you touched on Cher, and I think we mentioned a song she made, which was improved by something called Auto-Tune. Was it called Believe or something?
Yeah, it was. That was heavily auto-tuned. Yeah, I know. It's quite annoying, that technique, because you can always hear it.
I don't know if you can, but anyway, I came across this piece in one of the journals that I read to find out that auto-tune was in fact invented by a guy who was originally searching for oil. He was a mineralogist, and he used ultrasounds to, you know, send them into the earth and find out if there's oil there or back, and eventually turned this to the music industry. Embedded within auto-tune's many settings is a feature called discretize. It's this that made the system famous. When its extreme digital pitch correction is applied to a track, it results in a semi-artificial voice sound effect. Now, if that's the case and it works for Cher, then presumably any would-be pop star these days, it doesn't matter what their voice, his or her voice sounds like, they just turn on to auto-tune and they've got a sweet voice.
It's widely used in the studio, but of course they're always found out when they go out on the road, because you've got to be able to replicate that sound on stage.
Yeah, I see.
And lots of people can't.
Yeah, I know. It says here Rihanna used it in Disturbia, and Kanye West used it in Heartless. I mean, these people are, you know, iconic, legendary, world-famous singers who are now getting assisted in their singing. It's a bit like Lewis Hamilton being given a sort of auto drive, you know what I mean, to win a Formula One race.
Well, he is really, isn't he? Because a whole lot of people are involved in the construction of that car, which doesn't really exist before a race. It's all bits.
Yeah.
And then they put it together. They strip it all down again to transport it to the next Grand Prix, wherever that is. But, I mean, without the abilities of all those technicians, there wouldn't actually be a car to drive in the first place. So it's the result of all those people's efforts that allows him to win the race.
Yeah, but nevertheless, he has to keep pressing all the right buttons and pulling all the right switches to make it work. But anyway, look, it's interesting. Talking about pop stars, by the way, and again, we mentioned Mark Bolan briefly a few weeks ago. I see a new album is coming out with a collection of Mark Bolan songs sung by other artists. So you made the point when we last spoke that you thought he was a very good songwriter, had made a lot of good songs. It seems like others agree with you if they're now singing them as well.
He was a wonderful songwriter and a major influence on other artists as well. So BMG are bringing out an album called Angel Headed Hipster, featuring artists such as Elton John, Mark Almond, Nick Cave, U2, Joan Jett, directed by Hal Wilner, who tragically died of COVID a while ago. So it's a tribute to him as much as to Mark.
Wow.
But yeah, you know, many younger bands and artists do cite Mark Bolan as one of their greatest influences.
Really? Yeah. Well, you know, I
so I'm looking forward to this.
No, it'll be great. I mean, I said to you, I thought a lot of his songs started sounding the same, like, you know, Telegram Sam, you know. But I agreed with you also that Jeepster was his best song. I loved that. We used to go to what you would call the local hop. When I lived in Chester, there was a little village called Farndon outside Chester, and you know, somebody would rent the village hall there and put on a, you know, a dance, literally, next door to the pub, and we were all underage. And so we all used the pub at 15 or 16 or something like that, went to the hop now. But that was the days of, and I'm sure you weren't one of these, it was the days of girl skinheads. Do you remember girl skinheads?
Oh, God, weren't they ugly?
Yeah, utterly ugly. And they'd all turn up in their Crombie coats, their skinhead haircut, and their Dr. Martin boots and jeans. I'm not joking. But when they got in there and Mark Boland's Jeepster was on, they would bounce around like rubber bands. It was honestly unbelievable. You know, they would jump 4 feet in the air, you know, and kick their knees up and all that kind of stuff. That's what I remember from Mark Boland's Jeepster. But anyway, there you are. Now, Leslie Ann, of course, you are not just multilingual, you are sort of multinational, really, in the sense that, you know, you have such a wide range of experience of living in America and Britain and, of course, France, okay? And I've told you about my admiration for France before, but found this very French, this story that cropped up in the last couple of days. The British boss of a prestigious French theatre has lost her job after being accused of failing to say bonjour to her staff every morning because they said it was rude and shouldn't be done. I mean, you wouldn't get somebody in this country being sacked because he or she didn't say good morning to the staff when they entered the building.
It sounds dodgy, this. There's more to this story, isn't there, that they're not telling us? I mean, what was she doing? Was she saying good morning in English instead of bonjour in French? Or was she just ignoring them? Or what was going on here?
Yeah.
I can't see that anybody could be sacked for not saying bonjour.
Yeah, well, I just thought maybe it's something French. Maybe it's, you know, maybe it's so offensive not to say bonjour to somebody in France that you're immediately sort of declaring war on them or something like that. But, you know, whenever I've been in France, you say bonjour to everybody, a matter of course, don't you? It's the only...
Most people do because it's the only French word they know, right?
Yeah.
I think, have you not, because I certainly have, worked for many bosses over the years who've just ignored me completely when I've come in the morning.
Completely, absolutely. I mean, you know, there is a tradition in this country, like there is in Japan, say, for instance, in which you greet people when you first meet them. I totally agree with you. The pace of life in a newsroom or, a radio or TV station is so fast that nobody's got time to stop and say good morning. The most likely words to get when I ever walked into the Daily Express or whatever I was working for was, you know, don't take your coat off. Or it was something like, you know, like, get on the phone to so-and-so or get your arse over to Heathrow or something like that. There was no niceness or pleasantries about arriving at work, was there?
No, it was a very rough and undignified domain, wasn't it, really? And you became hardened to it very quickly.
Yeah.
And you gave as good as you got. Otherwise, you were out on your ass. There was no way round it.
Yeah.
You had to toughen up.
Yeah.
And I think it was a very good life lesson for a young reporter
to
be flung into the midst of the cauldron of Fleet Street and just, sink or swim, get on with it.
If you were
any good, you know, you gave back as good as you got.
Yeah, no, I totally agree with you. You mentioned Sir David English a bit earlier in this podcast when you had that unfortunate experience with Richard Gere and the fact that he had a false Rolex. I meant to say to you, I used to buy those about once a month on street corners in Manhattan. There was always a bloke there with literally a suitcase, hung around his neck. And you could get anything, a Rolex, you know, well, any make of what you wanted, really, and they were false and all that. And they looked so real. But where you were always found out is if you ever tried to take them into a jeweler's to ask them to replace the battery or something, they just wouldn't use them. In fact, they would actually, I went into one jeweler's once and said, oh, I need a new battery for this, you know. And they took it and they wouldn't give me back. They said, this is a false Rolex. You are breaking the law by wearing it. We're keeping it. And if you want to argue about it, we're going to call the police.
Yeah, and because America, well, New York especially, was the mecca of fake goods, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Fake designer goods. But we found out only years later that these purveyors of such items were supporting terrorism.
Yeah.
That all the money from the sales of those items was going to terrorist organizations and so on. So so we mustn't buy them anymore. But
no.
I mean, it sort of has a knock-on effect because, for example, I wear a Cartier watch that I really love. I've had it a long time.
Yes.
It's worth quite a lot of money, actually. But
yeah.
Everybody thinks it's a fake.
Yeah.
Because fakes are so common.
Well, they used to be. I agree with you. The other one that I used to sell in thousands were the Gucci watches, you know, which had the distinctive Gucci colours across the face of the...
The red and green stripe, wasn't it? Yeah.
But also, I've heard stories that customs officers will impound those off you if they see you wearing them, because they are, as you quite rightly say, originally some form of stolen goods, because they've stolen the actual, you know, plan... which made a Rolex and all that kind of stuff. You know what I mean? Anyway, look, that's for another time. Have you ever come across Sheridan Smith?
Not personally, no. I'm not a great fan, actually, I have to say. I think she's a bit Emperor's New Clothes.
Well, the reason I ask is because she's going to be on a TV show in the next few days talking about what's described here as a near-fatal battle with her mental health. It's a real old, you know, opening up on things and her journey through life and now becoming a mum and all that. I've been intrigued by following her career, because most of her career that I followed has nothing to do with the TV programme she's been in or the series. It's been about her walking out of a West End show because she's pissed.
Yeah, Stephen Fry did a similar thing, didn't he? Yeah. I mean, mental health, I don't denigrate this at all, because many people suffer, but it's become a bit of a celebrity stance.
Yeah, now there's a difference between Sheridan Smith being very drunk on stage, allegedly, because she's always denied it, you know, and Stephen Fry suddenly at the breaks, and I can't go back on stage and leaving, after a very long and well-documented battle with mental health. I think they're different.
Yeah, of course they are. But what I'm saying is, was she suffering the effects of overindulgence or was there more to it than that?
Yeah.
I think we have to be sympathetic because we don't know. But sometimes these people's suffering is projected beyond any kind of talent that they might have. I know that's a very controversial thing to say, but...
No, it's a very interesting thing to say, because, you know, there could be... What you're saying is, some people are more famous for their attitudes to life and their battles, their so-called battles with depression, that sort of thing, than they offer anything they've achieved.
Exactly. Mm. And you know, there's something a bit suspect about that. Don't we all get it out too much these days?
Yeah.
You know, are people not banging on about things that should remain private? Mm. And as you know, fight those battles privately. I suppose it helps some people to hear celebrities talking about them.
Yeah, I totally endorse what you're saying there. I've you know, over the years worked with lots of footballers, ex-footballers, sportsmen, ex-sportsmen, and one guy I worked with, whenever the going got tough, you know, because something had gone wrong in his life or he'd done something wrong in a fit of pique or something like that, he always either played the I'm very depressed card, okay, and I suffer from, you know, black moments and all that kind of stuff, or, and this is a black footballer, he would play the race card and make allegations, none of which I remember ever being stood up, of the fact that what had happened to him because, you know, he had black skin. And I totally agree with you. I think it's wicked to try and whip up some reason for your activities from an area where actually, if you are suffering from depression or if there is racial aggression against you, it should be taken very seriously and dealt with very seriously, and it cheapens it if you use it every time you have a problem.
Exactly that.
Mm, exactly. That's what I'm saying. So, but it happens all the time. Now, let me talk about something else which is quite controversial. Your father, of course, a legendary soccer reporter, writer, journalist. We all know about Ken Jones. Was your dad ever still working when the emergence of women's football being taken seriously happened?
Oh, yeah, and he was quite complimentary about it, actually. Yeah, we did talk about it, because I took my kids to see the Olympics 2012 women's football final at Wembley, which was the USA-Japan.
Yes.
Japan won, of course, and that was, I think, their third gold medal.
Yeah.
Pretty nifty team. It was an amazing occasion.
Yeah.
Record turnout, 80,000 fans.
Yeah.
My father explained it, and I think I remember it correctly, as this, that there isn't as much flow in the women's game.
Mm-hmm.
and that passing accuracy and ball handling and that kind of thing were not yet up to the standard of the men's game.
Yeah.
So the women's game is a bit scrappy, but Dad felt that it was coming on
right.
and that it had great potential.
Yeah.
What do you think?
So your father was supportive of it then? It
sounds very much
like,
so, yeah.
Like he took a very mature attitude towards it. Right. My in my opinion, if women want to play football, that's absolutely fine. They should be supported in doing that. They should be encouraged, particularly young girls. You know as well as I do, it's a huge game in America, in the US. I'm talking about teenage women's football, right? But what I kind of object to is that, like a lot of things that are minorities in this world, there are certain elements of the majority who decide that you have to over-egg the pie. You know, that this is so important, it should get as much coverage as the men's game. This is so important, it should get as much airspace as the men's game, as much time on television as the men's game. We must take it as seriously as the men's game, and everybody gets paid the same, and the pundits are, you know, great former footballers, either men or women. And actually, I do not believe there's that level of interest in women's football in this country. And therefore, I think women's football's been damaged by certain elements of maybe our profession over-promoting it and almost demanding that everybody should like it.
I hear you, because these things take time. Joey Barton, wasn't it, who said very controversially that women's football will always be an inferior product unless smaller pitches, smaller goals and smaller balls are introduced to the game. What's that about? You know, I think these things do take time. Mm. There's less money injected into the women's game.
Yeah.
The advertising is where the bulk of the money comes from.
Yeah.
So I think to build the women's game to be on the same level as the men's, you know, we need to take it slowly and steadily.
Yeah.
You can't make these things happen overnight.
Yeah, no, I totally agree with that. I mean, I want to be supportive, and if women want to play football, that's fine. But there's almost a demand that everybody recognises it as an equal game to the men's game. And what you just said about the way your dad described it, you know, certain areas of the game have got to still develop within the women's game and get better, is exactly what we should do. Not just, you know, keep pretending that it's on a similar level. It's not a similar level. And you know, playing on smaller pitches and all that kind of stuff, I don't remember Joey Barton saying what you just said, but of course you'll have researched that, and I'm certain he did. But I think that is patronising. I don't mind the smaller pitcher thing, but remember, within smaller pitches, the rules for the size of pitches varies greatly by about 20 yards each way. So that can always be got over in that sort of fashion. We touched on the US situation, the American election coming up a bit earlier on, Leslie-Ann, but I forgot to ask you what you're thinking now of Melania and her role, you know, the First Lady, in the campaigning strategy with Donald Trump.
Well, do you remember the pictures of her when he won the presidency?
Yeah.
That night she looked very glum that he'd won, as if to say, oh God, my life is never going to be the same.
Yeah.
I can see what's coming.
Yes.
Look, she was just a clothes horse. This is not the life she had expected. She was a Slovenian model. Mm. He was a modelizer, as they used to call them, in the era of the great supermodels.
Yes.
You know, he loved to chase down models, and mm-hmm. that was his game.
Yeah.
Trump was quite a charming, fun guy back in those days.
Yeah.
And he's taken a different route. I read quite a bit about her. They live very separate lives. They sleep in separate bedrooms.
Yeah.
She doesn't play golf. She likes her little spa that she has.
Yeah.
He keeps himself to himself. He loves his job. He loves power. Mm. She lets him get on with it.
Yeah.
And she keeps very much in the background.
Mm.
She's only, as well, the second foreign First Lady in US history.
That's right, yeah.
So there's all that to take into account.
Yeah.
I think she's disappointed. She has that written all over her. This is not the life she expected to lead. And every little thing and nuance about her private life is now pored over by the newspapers.
Mm.
And she doesn't want that. You can see it in her face.
I just can't get it together. You know, one moment she's literally campaigning for her husband, for the president, Donald Trump, vote for my husband, you need him back for another 4 years. And then flouncing off and trying to make out she doesn't like the life of being the world's most important woman. I find that difficult. Excuse me. It's not COVID-19, just a slight tip.
you can tell how she's confused, and, you know, she's obviously being told she's got to do a certain amount of campaigning and supporting him, and because previous first ladies have done so much.
Yes.
No, you know, Michelle Obama did so much. Yes. There are precedents which are set. Yes. So there are expectations. Frankly, Melania is not up to it. She doesn't have what it takes.
She doesn't have communication skills to do it.
No, she doesn't. She has, and I think she has very limited English, to be honest.
Yeah, I think she probably does as well. Right, we can't let today's podcast go without me reminding the world, as I have bored them with many, many times, that on this day, sadly, in 1997, Diana, Princess of Wales, died. And the person who broke that story to the world, Leslie Ann, was, in fact, the person you're speaking to now. And that was me. And I did that because I had a foreign correspondent out in Manila with the then foreign secretary, Robin, what's his name? You know, the guy who was very ugly, looked like Rumpelstiltskin.
With the redhead.
Yes, that's him. Yeah, yeah, sure.
Oh, God, yeah, he died as well, didn't he?
He died, I'm afraid, yeah, as well. Yeah.
Can't remember his name.
No, I can't either. But anyway, it was in the early days of mobile phones. I managed to get through to Charlie, the diplomatic correspondent who was with him, explain what was going on in France, and Charlie got back to me 20 minutes later, said he'd spoken to the foreign secretary, who'd just been notified that Diana had died. And so I took a hell of a gamble, and I put that out on the Press Association wire, 17 minutes ahead of the official announcement from Mr. Chavanamont, the French Foreign Secretary at the Elysee Palace. That one.
Good God, I never knew that. Yeah. I hope you got a rise for it.
For the 17 minutes, I was being sacked because the actual head of the Press Association was horrified that it had been put out before it had been verified by either the palace, by Downing Street, or by the French. And I said, no, I believe it. We've got it from the horse's mouth and all that. But for
some scoop.
Oh, absolutely. For 17 minutes, my life in journalism was in total abeyance. And then Fortune came out and announced it. And Charlie won the Story of the Year Scoop Award at the London Press Awards for it, which, of course, he deserved. So,
what a tragedy. To this day, it's still upsets me so much what's happened to her. I had just had a baby. I was sitting up in bed breastfeeding my newborn son with the television on at the end of the bed. Mm. And it, you know, those early, I think it was a Sunday morning, may have been a Sunday morning.
It happened at 4:20 a.m.
Yeah, I was up breastfeeding my baby in the bed. Yeah. And I remember just breaking down and waking my husband up and saying, they've killed her. I kept saying it, they've killed her. Yeah. And I felt that, you know, they killed the golden goose. Mm. The royal family has never been the same since.
No, it hasn't. I totally agree. It was a world-shattering event. The following day's Sun, which was then being edited by Stuart Higgins, an old pal of mine.
Higgy, the human sponge.
The human sponge, that's right. Do you know, it didn't carry one single word about anything else except Diana. And I mean that from front to back. They didn't carry any sport or anything. It was just a complete edition about everything to do with Diana's death, tributes to her and all that. It was quite remarkable.
Right. My eyes still fill with tears when I
think about it. Yeah.
Back to the funeral, you know, that was the saddest thing. God bless Diana.
Yeah, as the cortege.
But we've never forgotten her, have we? You know, she's not gone away.
No, not gone away. She'll remain immortal, I think. You're right. Okay, Leslie Ann, thank you very much indeed, my dear. And we will speak again very soon. To everybody else listening, thank you. And keep tuned to Planet Porky.
Said, you can't write this stuff, LA. Mm. I said, why not? This is one of my best intros ever.
Yeah, what was it, by the way? What?
The intro was, the most genuine thing about Richard Gere is his Rolex. What's wrong with that? I think that's really funny. And the features editor said to me, what you have to understand is that Sir David English wears a fake Rolex. I said, you were joking. He said, no, I can vouch for the fact that it's a fake. I was with him in Hong Kong when he paid $30 for it.
Good job. When I lived in Chester, there was a little village called Farndon outside Chester, and, you know, somebody would rent the village hall there and put on a dance, literally, next door to the pub, and we were all underage. And so we all used the pub at 15 or 16 or something like that, went into half an hour. But that was the days of, and I'm sure you weren't one of these, it was the days of girl skinheads. Do you remember girls skin?
Oh, God, weren't they ugly?
Yeah, utterly ugly. And they'd all turn up in their Crombie coats, their skinhead haircut and their Dr. Martin boots and jeans. I'm not joking. But when they got in there and Mark Boland's Jeepster was on, they would bounce around like rubber bands. It was honestly unbelievable. You know, they would jump 4 feet in the air, you know, and kick their knees up and all that kind of stuff. That's what I remember from Mark Boland's Jeepster. But anyway, there you are. Today is the 76th birthday of Mr. Richard Gere. Now, I never really fancied Gere at all. You know, the two films I've seen him in were Pretty Lady. Pretty Woman. Yeah, get that. Right. Well done.
Coda has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
If you're a custodial supervisor at a local high school, you know that cleanliness is key and that the best place to get cleaning supplies is from Grainger. Grainger helps you stay fully stocked on the products you trust, from paper towels and disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Plus, you can rely on Grainger for easy reordering, so you never run out of what you need. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.